From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, activist and physician Helen Caldicott. She helped galvanize the nuclear freeze movement by co-founding Physicians for Social Responsibility. But later she was ousted from the group and her marriage fell apart. Her new memoir discusses the impact of her activism on her family life. Also today, racial integration the Army way. We talk with sociologist Charles Moskos, an expert on race relations in the military and co-author of the new book, All That We Can Be. Moskos is also one of the architects of the military's Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy regarding gays and lesbians. And TV critic David Bianculli continues his look at the new TV season. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. Reform Party presidential nominee Ross Perot has filed suit in federal court demanding to be included in the debates next month between President Clinton and GOP presidential nominee Bob Dole. The suit was filed in U.S. District Court in Washington. Richard Verney is the national coordinator for the Perot campaign.
We will ask the court to act where the Federal Election Commission is unable to act. We will ask the court to grant a temporary restraining order and a permanent injunction against the fraudulent Commission on Presidential Debates conducting any event without the application of a fair and open process of applying predetermined objective criteria to the decision of participation.
Perot's suit claims that the planned Clinton-Dole debates constitute an illegal campaign contribution to the two major parties because the Commission on Presidential Debates is funded by tax-exempt contributions. Gunmen armed with automatic weapons have shot and killed at least 21 people and wounded more than 30 others at a mosque in Pakistan. The attack is the latest in a series of shootings at religious gatherings involving extremist groups. The BBC's Phil Goodwin reports from Islamabad.
Police say the attack on the Sunni Muslim mosque was clearly planned to cause the maximum number of casualties, taking place at a time when the killers knew it would be packed with worshippers. They say four gunmen entered the mosque as prayers began to be held before dawn, and opened fire with automatic weapons, firing and reloading for several minutes before leaving in a car waiting outside. Pakistani officials say most of the injured were men under the age of 20. The shooting took place less than 12 hours after a prominent member of an extremist militant Shia Muslim group, Deepa Muhammad, was killed in a nearby city. Police say it is too early to blame any particular group for the shooting while they are investigating.
The BBC's Phil Goodwin. Leaders from around the world today begin giving their annual addresses to the United Nations General Assembly in New York. Linda Fasulo reports.
For the next 3 weeks, presidents, prime ministers, and foreign ministers will address the General Assembly. Their presence this year comes at a time of uncertainty over UN finances and the future leadership of the world body. Both are issues that Washington has pushed to the forefront. The U.S. owes $1.6 billion to the U.N. and has threatened to use its veto in the Security Council to prevent current Secretary General Boutros Boutros-Ghali from serving a second term. Today, the Assembly is to hear from nations including Brazil, Norway, Nicaragua, and Iran. Tomorrow, it will be the turn of President Clinton and leaders from Russia, Japan, Britain, and Egypt. For National Public Radio, this is Linda Fasulo in New York.
On Wall Street at this hour, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down 35.5 points in light trading. The Nasdaq Composite is down 10. This is NPR. British police say they have broken up a major bomb threat by the Irish Republican Army. The police spokesman says officers arrested five men and seized up to 10 tons of explosives in raids early today. He says it's not clear what the intended target was, but the damage would have been massive. A dispute over a chain of islands claimed by Tokyo, Beijing, and Taipei heated up today with reports that Japan's Coast Guard chased away protesters challenging Japan's claim to the island. From Tokyo, NPR's Julie McCarthy reports.
Tokyo played down reports from Taiwan radio that it had expelled five boats from waters around the disputed islands. 17 Japanese patrol ships reportedly demanded that vessels carrying activists from Taiwan and Hong Kong immediately leave what the Coast Guard called Japanese territory. Japan's declaration of a 200-mile exclusive economic zone under the Global Law of the Sea Treaty was the tripwire for this long-dormant dispute. Possession of the islands would confer title over large areas believed rich in oil reserves. In the face of rising resentment, Tokyo has called for calm, and Beijing, fearing too big a surge of nationalism itself, has also attempted to put a lid on protests. In Tokyo, this is Julie McCarthy.
A new study finds that 9 out of 10 women are still alive 5 years after undergoing treatment for breast cancer. The study, which was presented at a conference in Vienna, involved over 5,000 European women who received a combination of radiation and conservative surgical therapy. The hatches have been closed between the space shuttle Atlantis and the Russian space station Mir after an emotional farewell ceremony. Shuttle Commander Bill Reedy gave the Mir cosmonauts a chocolate replica of Atlantis and watches set to Houston time. Astronaut John Blaha remained aboard Mir for a 4-month flight. Undocking is set for tonight. I'm Craig Windham, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Tomorrow, President Clinton will sign the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty at the United Nations. In the early 80s, when we sometimes seemed to be on the brink of nuclear war, Helen Caldicott was one of the best-known anti-nuclear activists. Now she's written an autobiography. It reveals the impact of the activism on her life as a wife and mother and describes some of the behind-the-scenes politics and backstabbing within the peace movement. Caldicott is an Australian pediatrician who gave up medical work to devote herself full-time to anti-nuclear activism. She framed nuclear war as a medical problem, the ultimate epidemic. She lived in the U.S. from 1977 to 86, where she was president of Physicians for Social Responsibility, an organization of 23,000 doctors committed to educating people on the dangers of nuclear weapons and nuclear war. She used to begin her galvanizing speeches by describing what would happen if a nuclear bomb was dropped on the building she was speaking in.
And then I'd describe the concentric circles of destruction which were first enunciated in a New England Journal of Medicine article in 1962, I think. And so it would depend on the size of the bomb, but I used to use a big one, a 20-megaton bomb equivalent to 20 million tons of TNT, or 4 times the collective size of all the bombs dropped in the Second World War. And I'd dig the hole 3/4 of a mile wide and 800 feet deep and turn everything within that volume to radioactive fallout. And I think 5 miles from the epicenter, everyone would be dreadfully burnt. Many would be vaporized. I used to describe a little boy in Hiroshima who was holding his hand up against the blue sky to catch a red dragonfly, and there was a blinding flash, and he disappeared and left his shadow on the pavement behind him. That's what these bombs do. And then out to 20 miles, everyone would be dreadfully burnt. People very far out, 50 or 60 miles, who actually just looked at the flash, as people did in Hiroshima, the heat is so intense their eyes would melt and run down their cheeks, because the eye is a very sensitive, delicate organ. And then I'd say what is left of the buildings would be lying, and what is left of the streets. The families would be separated and many dead. There'd be no physicians, no drugs, no hospitals. And as you lay dying, you'd say to yourself, why on earth did I let this happen? Why didn't I stop it occurring?
Now, why did you take that, very kind of emotional, frightening approach to talking about nuclear weapons?
Because to that point in time, the Pentagon had held sway and used its language, like we do in medicine, use medical language, to obscure the actual facts about what nuclear war meant. And as a physician, I felt obliged to boil this data down into lay language so people could actually understand what nuclear weapons were and how imminent the danger was, and that it would all be over in about an hour. The Russians launch their weapons, they take half an hour to land. Every town and city with a population of 25,000 or more was targeted in this country with at least one bomb, all factories, all military installations, the lot. And then during that half an hour, the American satellite would pick up the attack and their bombs would be launched too, so it would all be over in about an hour. And I thought it was very important to break through people's psychic numbing and sense of denial, so that they actually understood what this meant. It's like telling a patient who you've just diagnosed, maybe who has pancreatic carcinoma, to gently help them understand what that meant so they could enter the grief process and work through their grief, hopefully, before they died.
You had an enormous galvanizing effect in America and in your native country, Australia, and mobilizing people against nuclear weapons. In 1983, you resigned under pressure from Physicians for Social Responsibility. What was that about? What was their criticism of you?
Well, we founded it in 1978. It was a totally new organization from the one that first existed in the 60s, which subsequently died. And unfortunately, we used their name. And we, the young people who did this and created such a lively, dynamic, fascinating organization which led the peace movement, I think, in this country, we argued, we fought, but there was so much joy and so much love. And then towards 83, there was a man who was a very good lecturer who I admired, and he wanted to be on the board, which had just been re-elected, and there was no room. So I stood aside as an ex officio member as president, and he took my seat. And it was a bit strange because he didn't thank me. I was off traveling incessantly. I was raising $3 million, half of that for PSR a year and half for WAND, Women's Action for Nuclear Disarmament. But I was sort of helping to lead the freeze movement and talking to churches. And I mean, it was huge. But I could feel intuitively that things were not right at home back in Boston. There was stuff going on behind my back, you know, really negative stuff. You pick it up. And I didn't know how to counter it because no one was being honest. So what happened was he actually moved in and started working against me, whether it was jealousy, whether it was sexism, whatever it was. Now, I was not very old. I was late 30s, early 40s. And although I was a leader, I didn't actually realize I was a leader. And I didn't know how to counter negative energy, negativity that you see in all sorts of organizations. I've since learned how to do that.
There was a report, by, I think from an outside consultant that was commissioned by Physicians for Social Responsibility on the leadership of the group. And the report concluded that in any organization's life, a point is reached where a charismatic leader can become overpowering rather than empowering, referring to you.
Yeah.
Do you agree with that conclusion?
No. No. As we were going through this rather traumatic time, I turned to Bob Scrivener at the Rockefeller Foundation, who'd really been my mentor and who'd funded us enormously. And I said, you know, we're going through this, Bob. He said, look, all organizations go through this. It's a sort of an adolescence. He said, we can get you a management agency. And I said, well, I can't afford that $28,000. He said, we'll pay for it. And I thought that they would investigate it and find out what was going on, you know, and get to the root of the problem. And they wrote a report, much of which I agreed with, but virtually said I should leave PSR. And I was absolutely shattered. And I didn't agree with the conclusions of the report. But by that time, I was losing weight. I was being so affected by the negativity instead of the joy. It was really almost scary. So I eventually resigned, but under duress.
Did you go into hiding, more or less, after you were forced out?
Well, I continued talking. I mean, there was still tremendous demand for me to talk, but I lost the spontaneity and the joy with which I usually talked. And people still kept coming in droves to hear me talk, and I was a bit bitter, I have to say. Mostly because I didn't understand what had happened. And later I did come to understand. If I'm a bit like a dog with a bone, I gnaw on it until I understand the dynamics. And then the whole Nobel Prize thing occurred, which also was very traumatic. And I had nightmares about the thing for years, not myself personally, but about losing the organization, which was at that time so creative. We were on the Today Show, and I was debating with Teller, and I was about to debate with Richard Pearl, although he wimped out at the last minute. All sorts of things. We're having a huge impact on the country. And actually, at the time, the FBI had infiltrated PSR. To this day, I don't know who it was. We got the documents from the FBI, but it was all blacked out. You know, you have if and but and, but there was nothing viable that could be read. And so I have to also wonder if the thing was somewhat orchestrated, because we were taking on the most powerful organizations actually in the world, which were the military-industrial complex at the time, and threatening them enormously.
You kind of had a 1-2 punch in the 1980s, because after you were after you resigned under pressure from Physicians for Social Responsibility, your husband left you.
Yeah, well, we went home in 87 back to Australia, and because I was really truly burnt out, I could have sustained everything, talking about nuclear war and dreaming about it, but when my colleagues turned against me, I couldn't keep going. So we went home, and I bought an apron symbolically on our trip down to our lovely country house by the sea, thinking now, you know, we'll have the children, we'll have a wonderful family. But it just never happened, and I think Bill was resentful that I'd been away so much. I don't blame him, and I explore that in the book, trying to be honest with myself. And eventually, after 2 years, I think he told me he was leaving me on the eve of my 50th birthday, and that was about the lowest point I reached, I think. That was very difficult to recover from.
Well, how did you handle your period of depression? Did you want nobody? Did you want to hide that from everybody else? Did you want to protect your reputation? You know, Helen Caldicott is a strong, powerful woman. She's not allowed to get depressed.
Well, it's interesting because, you know, being in that position, people pedestalize you. They do put you on a pedestal, not knowing your private life and who you are. I can understand that because people need mentors and they sort of need heroes in a way. There aren't a lot except sports people now and film stars. And when you fall off your pedestal and show your feet of clay, they get very disappointed. But we're all fallible and we're all human. I was living by myself in a seaside house by the Pacific Ocean, and it was very beautiful. But I decided not to take any antidepressants because I wanted to work through this myself. I spent many hours in the garden. I had a support group around me, which was wonderful. And a very important thing happened to me about a year and a half after Bill left. You see, I ran around and asked my friends what they thought, looking for an answer, thinking, well, maybe this one will give me the answer. And one day I was working in my garden on a particularly grey day with these black cockatoos circling overhead. We call them funereal cockatoos. And I suddenly realised I'm alone. No one has the answer for me. And then I realised we're born alone and we die alone. And we must find our own way. And that was a very significant turning point where I started to grow.
Well, how did that help you?
Well, I knew I had to find my own answers, and it was almost a relief. And then I did lots of things. I did rebirthing for 10 days, thrashing around on a floor, pretending I was a sperm meeting an egg in the fallopian tube. I did a Buddhist retreat for 10 days, sitting cross-legged on the floor, meditating and not talking. None of these things helped. I did a sweat lodge thing. I did all sorts of things, searching and searching. I'd always felt all my life there was a higher power. I went as a little girl, I dressed myself up and took myself off to Sunday school and church. My parents were agnostics. I went to the Presbyterian Church, the Catholic Church, the Church of England. I found nothing. Eventually, I just became a cynical scientist and said, prove it to me. But in my search after Bill left, I happened to find a group who lived near me in Byron Bay, a most beautiful part on the north coast of New South Wales, and they persuaded me to do a seminar called Attunement to Soul, S-O-U-L, and I thought, oh no, not another Californian seminar. But I went, and it did change my life, and I learnt a lot about healing, a different sort of healing from the healing I'd been taught as a medical student and a doctor, about energetic healing. And it changed me. I felt different. I felt more peaceful. I felt more joy than I'd ever felt before. And I had some wonderful experiences, including an almost burning bush experience in nature, so that I now know there's something beyond me. I thought, well, I'd never find that. You know, gurus would and others would, but I would never know. But I did, and I feel so privileged, and it healed me, and I'm really a different person now.
What was your burning bush experience?
Well, I knew you'd ask that, and I've never talked about it, and I actually don't think I will at this time. I may write
That's
a book
fine,
about
yeah.
it called The Sacred Art of Healing, but I'm not quite ready to talk about that yet. But it was very, very powerful.
My guest is physician and anti-nuclear activist Helen Caldicott. She's written a memoir called A Desperate Passion. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. back with physician and anti-nuclear activist Helen Caldicott.
You know, I'm wondering, the years that you were crusading against nuclear weapons, you were very busy worrying about one of the world's biggest problems. Did that mean that you weren't spending much time thinking about your own personal situation? And when you were speaking less about the world's problems, did all your own little problems kind of team up and fight back?
It's a good point. Obviously, I wasn't home much, and Bill was resentful. I had three teenage children, and the one who most resented it was my daughter, my beautiful daughter, Penny. Now, you know, whether you're a good parent or bad parent, all kids rebel in adolescence, and Penny did. And she spent a lot of time with Bill, talking to Bill and became very close to him, and I wasn't there a lot. And she still has feelings about this, although we're very close now and about to build two houses next door to each other so I can be near my grandchildren, which is a joy. So I missed out on my children. I had a dilemma. Should I stay at home and bake cakes for them and be there when they got home from school? Yes, I should have. Or should I go out and make sure my children had a relatively safe future? And I opted for the latter and missed the former.
I think, you know, for anybody who has children, it's a really hard choice how much time to devote to work and how much time to make sure you're home with the family. Perhaps even harder for a woman because the traditional role of the woman is the person at home. You know, in rethinking the equation that you came up with between work and family, would you change it if you could go back?
When Bill left me, and I was so absolutely devastated. I remember I visited Boston on a speaking trip, and I was interviewed by the Boston Globe, and I said that all this work has been ashes in my mouth, that I should never have done it because I've lost a marriage. And for me, marriage is sacrosanct. It's archetypal. The family is a very significant, deeply psychological symbol. And I think that was partly why I was so devastated. However, as I recovered spiritually and psychologically from this, I realized that I could not have done it, that almost it was written on the blueprint of my soul, that I was impelled to do it. I could feel the heat of the bombs. I knew what was going to happen. My intuition was accurate, and I had to act on that. And that I was almost born to do this. I'm not saying this with an arrogance. I'm just saying that that's what I feel.
I want to get back to nuclear weapons. The Cold War, which was still raging when you started speaking out against nuclear weapons, is over. The General Assembly just endorsed a treaty that would end nuclear weapons testing. Do you feel, looking back, that nuclear war really wasn't on the verge of happening after all? Or do you feel that it's in part because of the work of that you did and that people like you did that the Cold War ended and we have a treaty in the works?
No, I think it's the latter. I spent an hour and a quarter with President Reagan in 83 in the White House downstairs library talking about nuclear weapons, and his knowledge was minimal, if not zero. He quoted to me from the Reader's Digest, which he called his intelligence files. I'd just written Missile Envy, and I had all the data at my fingertips. He wasn't very bright. Clinically, it was a very alarming meeting, and yet he had the football at his disposal, the nuclear codes. Soon after that, he was using this belligerent rhetoric of the evil empire, and we had to prepare ourselves for nuclear war and the like. There was a NATO exercise where NATO, really America, was buzzing Soviet nuclear facilities in Eastern Europe. And there was a double KGB CIA agent in London who heard that unless the exercise was called off within 5 hours, the Soviet Union was going to strike a nuclear strike against America. He contacted Thatcher, who called Reagan in the middle of the night and woke him up and said, unless the exercise is aborted, there will be a nuclear strike within hours, and it was aborted. That man subsequently was excommunicated from Russia, from his family, and when Gorbachev got into power, he came back. I was on a radio show on Monday recently in Washington where a man called up and said, yes, I was involved in that. It was indeed a terrifying time.
What do you consider the greatest impact of your work as an anti-nuclear activist?
I believe, and it's not just my work, Terry, it's the work of millions of people, not just in this country, and the church's wonderful dedicated people, but throughout the world, and of course Gorbachev. I believe the greatest miracle of this century is that the Cold War ended. I never believed, as I struggled round like the anti-nuclear bag lady round this country and the world, I never in my heart of hearts, I would never have said it. I never believed the Cold War would end. The belligerence, the antagonism was so profound that I would stagger off the stage trembling by people's animosity when I said we have to learn to live with the Russians. Russian flesh burns at the same temperature as American flesh. They're our brothers and sisters. I never thought it would happen. But, you know, it's happened, and I don't think we've given ourselves enough credit for it, nor really understand the true significance of that.
You started off professionally as a pediatrician, and you've often said that you changed from pediatrician to anti-nuclear activist because you decided instead of saving a few children, you'd be better off saving all children by trying to prevent a nuclear war. When the Cold War ended, did you think, maybe I'll return to being a pediatrician now?
I still think that. I miss medicine enormously. I absolutely love it. And I think maybe I'll go and retrain back in Australia and work with my daughter, who's a general practitioner in an all-female practice. I'd love to do that. Yet the risk has not gone. The CTB, Complete Test Ban Treaty, was passed by the United Nations. Meanwhile, the scientists in America, Los Alamos, Lawrence Livermore and the like, are planning and designing a new generation of nuclear weapons. They are continuing subcritical testing, blowing up plutonium in the desert in Nevada, have huge computers in hand to test, to build and design more sophisticated nuclear weapons. This country still has at least 15,000 weapons when 1,000 could induce nuclear winter and the end of all life on Earth. Meanwhile, the Pentagon is in Russia decommissioning the Russian weapons. So now is the time that America could rise to its full moral and spiritual height. Could, with Russia, disarm both countries simultaneously within 5 years, abolish nuclear weapons, then it would have the full moral force to say to France, to China, and to England, and to Israel, okay, that's it. All weapons are to be dismantled, and then that'll be it. Yeah, there'll be terrorist bombs, for sure. There'll be a few rogue nations that build their weapons, but we won't still be living under the threat of nuclear annihilation. If that doesn't happen, I predict within 10 years, at least 20 countries will have built their own nuclear weapons. So we're really at the crossroads of time, Terry.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Helen Caldicott's new autobiography is called A Desperate Passion. She now divides her time between Australia and the U.S. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, the Army approach to racial integration. We talk with sociologist Charles Moskos, co-author of the new book, All That We Can Be. He says the civilian world can learn a lot about equal opportunity by studying the Army. And TV critic David Bianculli previews some of this week's new shows. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We don't think of the military as being on the cutting edge of social change, but Charles Moscow says there's an exception, racial integration. He says the civilian world would benefit by studying how the Army has gone about creating equal opportunities for African Americans. Moscow is a sociologist who studies life in the military. He's the co-author of the new book, All That We Can Be, Black Leadership and Racial Integration, The Army Way. Moscow was also one of the architects of the Don't Ask, Don't Tell policies on gays and lesbians in the military. He says there's probably more racial mixing in the Army than in civilian life. He writes, within the Army, the more military the environment, the more racial integration you're likely to find. I asked him to explain.
Well, in field situations, in deployments like Somalia or Bosnia, there's absolute racial integration. On post, it's about 90%. Perhaps off post, the races tend to go their own ways, but not to the degree they do in civilian life. I think it's interesting to contrast a dining facility in an Army base compared to the typical dining facility in a university campus. You'll see black and white soldiers eating together, more or less at random. There are no such things as a black table or an all-white table. And that is perhaps one of the most indicative features of how racially integrated it is. There's also been a study done on racial integration in civilian communities, and the most racially integrated communities in American society are those that are located near major posts, such as near Fort Bragg, Fort Sill, Fort Hood. Posts of this sort also have the communities are most the most racially integrated.
You also point out that Army culture is becoming more African American.
We like to use the term in our book, Afro-Anglo culture. We think that in the enlisted ranks especially, not only do blacks adopt to mainstream values, but whites, to a surprising degree, also adopt to Afro-American standards. And we think the lesson for American societies here is that our entire society must realize how important the Afro-American element is in our core culture. There's probably not another society in the world in whose international image is so much shaped by what many perceive as a racial minority in our own country. We would also argue that as blacks are truly core Americans, it's incumbent for white Americans also to realize, in a sense, culturally, they are part black.
When you say that whites in the Army adapt to African-American culture, what are some examples of that? What do you mean?
It's very evident in, say, music tastes. It's evident in, to some degree, speech patterns. I think one of the greatest examples, if one goes to a church service on a military base. This came vividly to mind when I was in Somalia. I was attending a service on a Sunday morning in which the choir was predominantly black. Those in the attendance were predominantly white, including the minister. But after a while, I noticed that with the calls and responses, the type of hymns that were being sung, I was actually attending a black Protestant service, even though the majority of the parishioners there happened to be white. That was one example of where Afro-Anglo culture kind of melds in a military setting.
The Army has been officially desegregated since 1948. When did it start opening up for real?
There were two levels. In the early 1950s, racial integration at the lower levels began operating fairly effectively, but it was only really in the late 70s and the early 80s that leadership roles were truly racially integrated. What the Army did was to develop certain programs to bring young men and women up to standards for commissioning. Two examples might bear out the point. One is that historically black colleges and universities produce about half of all black officers now entering the Army. This is a generally unrecognized resource in American society. These so-called HBCUs are key providers of black leaders. Another is the United States Military Prep School, which takes young men and women and tries to bring them up to the standards that will get them admitted to West Point. The other services have similar kinds of prep schools. Basically, it's a 13th year of high school, and the emphasis is sheerly on writing, reading, and mathematical skills. And after a year of this extensive training at the so-called prep school, many, many black young men and women are then able to enter West Point. About half of all West Point cadets who are black are products of this U.S. military prep school.
What is the Army approach to affirmative action?
The Army approach to affirmative action is a successful approach. It's based on what we call supply-side conditions rather than demand-side. That is, goals are set to be met based on the number of minorities in the qualified pool, not on numbers concocted to represent gross population numbers. Thus, for example, if 10% of all the first lieutenants are black, the goal for the promotion to the captain level should also be 10%. In the Army case, by focusing on in-service training programs, minorities, and most notably blacks, are brought up to meet these standards. Any organization can buy, you know, a sort of a short-term solution by lowering standards, but that only brings about long-term disaffection. I think the Army, by taking the heat in the late 70s and the early 1980s, by not dropping standards, eventually showed this is the best way to go about it. Therefore, when you have qualified black leaders, as you do in the Army, you don't find the kind of resentment toward affirmative action that exists in many civilian organizations.
Is it true that there isn't resentment in the Army?
Of course there's resentment in the Army, but the level of it is much lower than what one would find in a normal, say, university or corporate setting. You also have an interesting figure, too, that even in the federal government, blacks are 2.5 times more likely to be fired than our white employees. And this is an interesting statistic because the government, the federal government, of course, is very concerned about equal opportunity. Yet in the Army, the figures are somewhat the other way around. A black is more likely to finish an enlistment than is a white. So we have another example of how the difference is between a civilian organization, the federal government, and a military organization such as the United States Army.
Any guesses what's behind that statistic? That African-Americans are more likely to finish than whites in the Army?
The reason that blacks are more likely to finish their terms of enlistment than white soldiers is, I think, largely because of the role of the black sergeant. These are people who have come up the hard way themselves. They are very concerned that black soldiers come up to standards. The Army may be one of the few places left or black leaders might say to a wayward younger black soldier, you're a disgrace to the race. That kind of setting up of high standards and standards that can be met is, I think, the secret behind the Army story. There's another variable, too, which is for liberals, is there's always, for liberals, a tendency to focus on white racism rather than on increasing black opportunity. Ironically enough, in the Army, hate speech is not nearly as condoned as it would be on a typical university campus. But in a typical university campus, you'll rarely find black leaders, at least in a mainstream white university.
Did you say racism is more condoned on an Army base?
If one utters racist statements in a civilian university setting, you would certainly be severely reprimanded, if not removed from the university setting. In the Army, what you do in your private life is your own business. Of course, if you do display racist sentiments, you're certainly not going to get promoted. But hate speech per se is not a misdemeanor or crime in an Army setting, as it would be in many civilian contexts.
Yeah, you write in your book that racism is punished not when it's just a spoken epithet, but when it results in actions that have consequences.
Racist statements only are punished if they break up good order and discipline.
Mm-hmm.
It's in the same level as if one insulted one's mother. But the race element per se is not considered the core of the argument, as it is in many civilian settings. Another issue is that when you do have black leaders in great numbers in an organization, racist statements, of course, don't have the sting that they might have in an organization where black leaders are virtually absent.
And you say that if a fight starts as a result of a racist action, that both sides are punished.
That's correct. It's if you do get into fisticuffs or violence, both sides will be punished, no matter what the cause of the altercation was.
Charles Moskos is my guest. He's co-author of the new book, All That We Can Be, Black Leadership and Racial Integration the Army Way. Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. back with Charles Moskos. He's a sociologist who studies the military. His new book is called All That We Can Be, Black Leadership and Racial Integration, The Army Way. Are there many more African Americans in the military now than there were before we had an all-volunteer army?
There are many more black Americans in the military since the end of the draft. At the end of the draft, the proportion of blacks in the military is roughly proportionate to the number of blacks in the total population, approximately 14%. Today in the Army, it's approaching 30%. Of course, the total numbers are much lower because the military generally and the Army especially are much smaller than they were during the time of the draft. The percentage is high, but the total numbers are relatively low. One of the points we make in the book, too, is that the end of the draft, which really began unwinding toward the latter years of the Vietnam War, might be one of the contributing factors to the growth of a so-called underclass in American society. We figure about 70,000 fewer black males are entering the military annually today than would be under the rates of the peacetime draft between the wars in Korea and Vietnam.
How do you think that might be contributing to the growth of the underclass?
We will have at least 70,000 fewer jobs a year, for starters. And secondly, for those who did enter the military, especially during peacetime, it was a time of removal, perhaps from an impoverished background, a new kind of a cultural orientation in an organization in which there were black leaders, a generally conservative organization in terms of social values, and at the same time, perhaps most important of all, there were GI Bill benefits. That is, after a term in the military, one could then get job training or college education generously subsidized by the U.S. government. The GI Bill principle, which was, of course, very operative after World War II, continues to operate even today, and it's probably the biggest source of educational advantage for minority group members than any other federal program.
Let me offer a cynical view of why the number of African Americans in the military grew after the end of the draft. White people weren't drafted anymore. A lot of white people didn't want to serve. Therefore, America really needed more African Americans. I'm sure you've heard that viewpoint expressed. Do you think there's any legitimacy in that?
One thing that always disturbs me is when certain black leaders make the point that, well, blacks enter the military because they have no other options, as if blacks were not patriotic, or as if all blacks who were in the military would be unemployed otherwise. I find that rather objectionable. The fact of the matter is that people like Colin Powell and another 30 or 40 active duty generals today who are black reflect the highest standards of American meritocracy. And it doesn't well serve blacks in the military for people to say that the only reason blacks are disproportionately represented in the Army are because they have no other opportunities and whites won't do it. Now, turning to the white case, one interesting outcome of the end of the draft is, of course, the virtual disappearance of the white liberal in the enlisted ranks. We find ourselves recruiting more and more from a narrow white social base as we find ourselves recruiting more and more from a wider black social base. But all this is going to be somewhat moot because of the drawdown that's occurring. There are going to be more people trying to get into the military, white and black, than there are going to be spaces available. The military is about half the size it was before Vietnam, and it's continuing to shrink. And that end of opportunity to be able to join the armed forces, I think, is going to severely affect not only the white lower middle class, but especially the black lower middle class.
I don't know if your reaction will be the same to this point of view, the point of view that the Army represents an opportunity, a job opportunity, an education opportunity for a lot of young African Americans who have limited opportunities because of job discrimination and so forth in the civilian world.
The military does give job opportunities for people who might not otherwise have them. But the fact of the matter is that with a shrinking military, the very bottom of the social scale, white or black, really cannot join. Virtually every member who joins the Army today is at least a high school diploma. That already means that you're getting some kind of sifting out of people who have the worst opportunities, that is the high school dropout.
Have you heard this criticism, that it's unfortunate in a way that there's such a large representation of African Americans in the Army, because if there is a war, African Americans will be cannon fodder and they will suffer disproportionately to white Americans?
The big lie today is that African Americans suffer disproportionate casualties in times of combat. This wasn't true in the Vietnam War, and it hasn't been true since. Our book has a table in there, which is the first time this has ever been in print. We have looked at every combat operation since the end of the Vietnam War, from the Mayaguez up through the bombings in Dairen. And blacks compose approximately 14% of all those killed. And that includes Somalia, it includes the Panama, the Gulf War, etc. That's about the number of blacks that there are in the total population, and somewhat under the number of blacks, of course, that are in the armed forces. In Vietnam itself, blacks constituted 12% of all those killed in action. Again, a number very close to the national proportion. Yet we don't seem able to scotch that big lie that blacks somehow are cannon fodder. The data is quite clear, they're not.
I wonder if you've run into a lot of African-Americans who've served in the military, who've maybe even had to fight in the recent past or the more distant past, and then felt betrayed by American culture when they reentered the civilian world and found that they didn't have equal opportunity there.
The surveys of veterans show that black veterans are much more unhappy about having left the service than our white veterans. I think that's indirect evidence of the fact that civilian society doesn't offer those kind of opportunities. But even more dramatically, we have a lot of black generals who have retired after 20, 25, 30 years of military service who don't find the kind of opportunities in the civilian corporate world or civilian life that one would expect. Here are people who have been generals, who run multi-million dollar organizations, commanded thousands of troops, and often can't find positions equivalent to the kind of expertise they now command. But we also have on the other side many black sergeants retiring, great numbers of those every year, who would probably be very ideal to be teachers in a lot of school settings. Now, they'll have to acquire teaching certificates and things of that sort, but we do have a kind of group appearing now in great numbers, black retiring sergeants, who I think are going to be a very positive element in the black community. One of the points that John Sibley Butler and myself make in the book is that the black sergeant is, in a sense, now the social equivalent of what the old black middle class was during the segregated era. Of course, what makes the black sergeant different, not only is he a leader of black soldiers, but he's also a leader of white soldiers.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Charles Moskos, and he's a sociologist who spent many years studying the culture of the military. He's the co-author of the new book, All That We Can Be, Black Leadership and Racial Integration, the Army Way. Now, I believe you were one of the architects of the Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy toward homosexuals in the military. Are you surprised by how that has played out?
Well, Don't Ask, Don't Tell is a perfect compromise because nobody's happy with it. But it seems to have gotten the issue off the front pages. The major reason I came up with Don't Ask, Don't Tell was that for the first 6 months of the Clinton administration, both the military and the administration were being dominated by this question. Don't Ask, Don't Tell is kind of operationalizes what always has been kind of a military policy anyway. When I was in the Army, of course, there were gays in my unit, but it was done very discreetly. Here we have a situation where, it's not a perfect world, but it seems to have been a modus vivendi that seems to have worked pretty well. Now, it will go to the Supreme Court, and I don't know how that will come out. My reading now, though, is it probably will be upheld. But Don't Ask, Don't Tell is probably going to be with us for some time to come.
If you didn't have to worry about the politics behind how to handle gays in the military, if you were just trying to do right by the military without worrying about Clinton stature or what's happening in the legislature, what would you recommend?
I would probably recommend Don't Ask, Don't Tell anyway. The issue is there are only three times in life probably where you're forced to live with people you wouldn't otherwise choose. One is jail. Two is the Army. And the third is probably freshman dorms. In these cases where you are involuntarily placed with people whom you might not choose to live with, I think you have to respect privacy rights. We do respect privacy rights between men and women. And I think we can also respect it between straights and gays. So I think a little bit of discretion on both sides is how to make the situation work. But to have open gays serve in the military, that, you know, might be worked around, but it would create a lot of second-order problems. What do you do about partner rights? What do you do about a straight guy being assigned to live with a gay guy? No country, by the way, in the world, contrary to popular opinion, ever treats gay soldiers and straight soldiers exactly the same, including Scandinavia and the Netherlands. There are always distinctions made. And I think in our society, we have a unique case where we have a strong religious right and a strong left lifestyle group as well. And in that kind of situation, you're going to have to come up with compromises like don't ask, don't tell.
Would there be a way, though, of instead of punishing somebody's sexual orientation, just not allowing the expression of sexual behavior in the barracks? I mean,
well, we don't.
It's already not allowed, right?
Well, we don't do that for men and women, though. I mean, we don't allow men and women to shower together just because we base that on status, not on behavior. So we do have certain norms, rightly or wrongly, of privacy, particularly with regards to sexual identity and sexual matters. That's why I think you can't really have an open gay policy in a confined setting.
What, by your standards, is the most enlightened policy abroad?
I don't think one can say that's most enlightened. I mean, the Brits have just decided to keep the ban full force. Yet the Scandinavian countries and Netherlands have decided that gays can openly serve. Though, as one gets closer to the ground in those countries, there are a lot of conditions that aren't very apparent. For example, most gays can choose civilian options and rarely go into the military in the first place. In the Dutch case, if a drafted gay says, "I cannot serve because it makes me sexually uncomfortable or aroused serving next to males," you'll be excused from the draft. It's something that there is no finite answer to, Terry. There are issues of privacy, sexual orientation rights, and we're just going to sort of meander along, I think, in this kind of halfway house for the indefinite future.
Charles Moskos is the author of All That We Can Be, Black Leadership and Racial Integration, The Army Way. He's a professor of sociology at Northwestern University. Coming up, more previews of new TV shows. This is Fresh Air. Once again, TV critic David Bianculli is here to offer a guide to the week's new series, which ones to sample and which to avoid.
Last week, the new shows I recommended were Cosby and Pearl on Monday nights on CBS and Spin City with Michael J. Fox on Tuesday nights on ABC. All of those shows did great in the ratings, but the real test is this week. If viewers come back for a second helping, that means they liked what they saw, and the network gamble of paying big bucks for star TV talent, especially Bill Cosby and Michael J. Fox, really paid off. Tonight, the second episode of Cosby competes directly against the first episode of NBC's The Jeff Foxworthy Show. That show isn't technically a premiere. It's more of an overhaul, because last season The Jeff Foxworthy Show was on ABC. And while changing networks, Foxworthy changed just about everything else. He got a new TV wife, one new TV kid, and moved to a new TV setting, Georgia instead of Indiana. But one thing didn't change. The old show on ABC wasn't any good, and neither is the new show on NBC. Also tonight on NBC, opposite Pearl, is Mr. Rhodes, which stars stand-up comic Jeff Rhodes as a new teacher at a conservative prep school, like there's any other kind. Mr. Rhodes is an upper-class Welcome Back Cotter, but it's not as funny. And remember, Welcome Back Cotter wasn't that funny to begin with. Mr. Rhodes isn't worth skipping Pearl to see. Although, to his credit, Jeff Rhodes does get off at least one good line during his classroom monologue.
"This being the first day, I thought we'd get acquainted and get a little groove thing going."
"Who wants a groove thing going? I mean, who wants to be here, period? Wearing this stupid monkey suit?"
"Hey, Milo, don't be knocking the uniform, man. It saves you guys from making that stupid rich kid fashion mistake, trying to look like rappers." "I love seeing white suburban kids trying to pull off that whole gangster attitude." You see them at the mall. They just don't feel the vibe I'm putting out at the yogurt shop. I didn't ask for no sprinkles. Sorry, DJ Jazzy Trevor. I didn't know the food court was yours, buddy.
On Tuesday, the one new series is Relativity, by the creators of 30-something and My So-Called Life. It stars David Conrad and Kimberly Williams as young adults who fall in love, even though she's just about to be engaged to another man. It's a thoughtful, interesting, well-acted drama, and it's told in a serialized form. But that's the problem. After this Tuesday night sneak preview, ABC is moving Relativity to Saturday nights, where no serialized drama has a chance of getting a regular audience. So no matter how good it is, Relativity is relatively doomed from the start. Wednesday night, there's nothing new. On Thursday, the big news is the season premiere of ER. On Friday, there's a new ABC series for kids that's cleverly done, Sabrina, the Teenage Witch. It stars Melissa Joan Hart from Nickelodeon's Clarissa Explains It All, and it's kind of like a teen Bewitched. Paired with ABC's new Clueless series, which premiered last week, Sabrina could turn out to be a very popular hour among teen viewers. The weekend is easy. No new series premiere on Sunday, but there are three new ones on Saturday. Common Law on ABC, Early Edition on CBS, and Love and Marriage on Fox. None of them is good, and Love and Marriage in particular is the worst new show of the entire season. So to recap, on ABC, Relativity is good for adults, and Sabrina the Teenage Witch is good for kids. Otherwise, no new premiere this week is good for anything.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Daily News. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Technical direction from Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Sharrock directs the show. I'm Cherry Gross. Fresh Air is available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $15.45 and includes shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.